Good morning. Glad you could join us. Call the meeting of the State Affairs Committee to order. We have President Senator Taylor, Senator Miller, and myself, Chairman Senator Lehman. First item of business today is Senate Bill 161, an act related to interest rates and calculation of interest under certain judgments and decrees, and on refunds of certain taxes, royalties, or net profit shares, and providing for effective date. I have first person to testify as the Attorney General, and I see that he's not here. Is there someone here from the Department of Law?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Joe Gallahan. I'm an Assistant AG, and Will James is also with me, the Attorney General. Sends his regrets he couldn't be here, and he sent a couple caddies down to tell you briefly what the bill is about and answer any questions you may have. Will James is also here. He is in the...
Is your microphone forward?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Mr. James is here. He is in the oil and gas section. I work in the governmental affairs section. There are two fairly distinctly different portions in this bill, both related to interest, and it doesn't present a single subject problem. But Mr. James is here to talk about the royalty provisions in Section 2 and 3. But briefly, Section 1 is related to pre- and post-judgment interest, and that would be judgments that an individual receives through the court system. It is the belief of many of the agencies and the Attorney General that a change in the both pre- and post-judgment interest rates is warranted, and it should reflect market rates as opposed to just a fixed statutory rate, which frankly we believe is just arbitrary, and sometimes it will hurt individuals, sometimes it will help depending on inflation or deflation. But there are easy to ascertain market rates that we can peg interest on, and that's what Section 1 does. Some of the later sections just talk about the effective date, but the guts of the provision that I helped draft up with the help of the Department of Transportation and folks at Administration and Risk Management call for a market rate on interest. To the Senator's staff, we provided some answers to some questions. I think I hope that the committee has those, but if I can answer any more questions about Section 1, I'd be delighted to.
Okay, do we have any questions for Mr. Gelda? I guess I have a question on the question and answer sheet that you passed out on the last page. The last question, there's the last question, and then there's an answer that says, that's my understanding. I guess my question is it or is it not so?
Well, I believe that relates to the question on taxation, which is in Section 3, and Mr. James is probably...
Okay.
Mr. James would be filling in for Jim Baldwin, but he is in a far better position to answer any questions. So
okay.
That is my understanding. But Mr.
Okay. Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, I just got in on this thing. Did you talk about Section 2, Mr. Gill?
No,
that'd be Mr.
Oh, that's someone different?
I just want to know.
You're not the fountain of all knowledge here this morning?
My ignorance is vast.
I just note for the record, we've been joined by Senator Duncan and Ellis. And Senator Duncan,
okay, I'm sorry.
Mr. Gelap said he's going to discuss Section 1, and Mr. James is going to come and enlighten us on Sections 2 and 3.
That's why I should be here on time.
I have warned you that if you come late, we're going to go ahead without you.
If I come late and I ask dumb questions, you're not going to bail me out.
It's like my arrangement with the airlines. If I get there late, they go on without me.
And they should.
But if you're there early, you get a free ticket.
Really?
So I come from.
That has never happened. Maybe I've never been there early. Any questions, Mr. Gelda? Thank you. You're welcome to stay at the table, and maybe Mr. James goes through this, then we can just get you both at the same time.
Good morning, I'm Will James, and I just found out a few moments ago that I was going to be in here to testify, so I really don't have anything prepared. I am available to answer questions if you have any particular questions on sections 4, 5, and 7, I guess now. Is that right? They changed it. work draft 3, 4 and 7.
Right, which one of you two is handling section 2?
This is the work draft, and I think they changed it.
Are you looking? You know what?
This is the section 2 is the Anchorage amendment, and I have really nothing to say about that.
Okay. I'd like to have a motion for adoption of the committee substitute so we can put that before us to discuss.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ellis, moves any objection? So we have before us CS for Senate Bill 161, State Affairs. And we have, I believe, someone online who will speak to the so-called Anchorage Amendment. Do we have any questions, Mr. James? Did you hear my question on page 4 of this question answer sheet? The question is, so if the state's assessment is wrong and someone pays the tax assessment, they may get a higher interest rate on the refund portion of their tax bill. The answer, that's my understanding, is that the answer, or is the answer yes, or is the answer no, or is there some question about it?
Well, I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I haven't seen that, and I'm not familiar with that question, and I'm not sure of the context in which it's being posed. So. Which question is it?
Okay.
Let me ask a question. Who in the Department of Law drafted this bill?
No lights come on. I don't understand the question.
Jim Baldwin, who is out of town. I am somewhat familiar with it. The answer, having read that question now, it is intended to increase the interest rate on the refunded money. That is correct.
Do we have any further questions for these two gentlemen? Senator Taylor?
Let me phrase it this way. We have a judgment entered, excuse me, a case is brought, as in your example, say tomorrow, the case is filed. 2 years from tomorrow, the judgment is entered. At that time of the entry of the judgment is when we calculate what the interest rate is on prejudgment interest. Well, right here.
Use your microphone.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor, that would be correct, because you probably wait to find if you get a favorable judgment before you do your calculations. You could, under the proposed bill, you could ascertain what the prejudgment rate would be, assuming you win. Because when you file the case and serve the summons on the other side, you then go back to the week previous T-bill sale, and that would be your prejudgment interest rate. And you live with that rate until you get a judgment. When you get a judgment, you can then calculate the prejudgment interest, going back to the T-bill sale before you file the case. At the time you get a judgment, you take the week's previous T-bill sale, and that becomes your judgment interest rate, and you live with that until you get satisfaction from the other side.
So there are only two times at which you would need to know what the rate was. One would be the 1 week before the date of filing. The other would be 1 week before the date of judgment. For all times in between, it doesn't matter how that interest rate may fluctuate up or down.
That is correct, and under this proposal.
Because the other one had me, that was one of the main concerns I had, was the computations and calculations would be necessary in allowing it to float. But it becomes fixed, in essence, by the choice of the party filing the litigation.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct.
Further questions?
Yeah, there is, apparently there is also a savings clause in here which provides for rates of interest set by contract, if in fact the litigation involves a contract pay a specified rate, as long as it's under the usury amounts, of course, and can be enforced, then that contract rate would establish the prejudgment rate, but would not the post-judgment rate still be the same? In other words, wouldn't the post-judgment rate again be fixed by the sales of T-bills the week before judgment, as opposed to whatever the contract indicated?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, unless the contract, of course, called for two different interest rates, one for prejudgment and one for post-judgment interest rate.
Well, my thought was, that was my conclusion also, and my immediate thought was that the banks will of course, insert a new clause into all of their notes and contracts, and that is that you will pay interest at the following rates, and if we have to bring suit against you, that will establish our pre-judgment rate. Post-judgment rate shall be, and there will be a new amount. Now, I've never seen that done before, and yet I could also visualize where, let's assume we go back to the Carter years and we end up with very high interest rates. We may say 18% or something at the bank, and then the rates drop back to say 5% or wherever they are today. A person that had a long-term note would be wise not to pay the note. Let the bank go to court, bring judgment against them, and confess judgment. And by confessing judgment, establish the new interest rate of 5%. You'd save yourself 13% on your money by letting them sue you, because your post-conviction judgment amount would be so much later, lower, very significantly lower. Unless the contract itself had a modifying clause in it, as you've indicated. I may have wandered off the track on what you were attempting to accomplish here, and I may be totally wrong in my analogy, so please correct me if I am.
Well, I would just note, Mr. Chairman, that I think the Attorney General is basically committed to people that want a contract for rates, however they want to set that up. I think he's philosophically believes that's good and that they should be allowed to do that. Certainly, parties, individuals signing contracts can't anticipate every problem, but they should have a whack at it, I guess. This just addresses if they don't deal with that. This is how the rules of the pre- and post-judgment situations will apply.
I guess my question is the analogy that I gave you in that rather rambling example correct? Would that be the outcome under this law?
Mr. Gelda.
Well, I suppose that in a situation of extensive inflation, it would be possible that people would take advantage of an inflationary period to try to skinny out of their obligations.
I don't think it would happen actually during an inflationary period, because letting somebody take you to court and sue you would actually jump the rate at which you're paying interest. Right now you might be paying 6 or 7%. You get to where you got 14-15% interest running at the market level by bringing the suit, and even just bringing the suit, they can jump your interest rate if they're going to prevail. And have the suit take a couple extra years, they could double the interest rate on you by doing that, over and above the contract rate that you had agreed to if it was a fixed rate. So I don't see that happening. I don't see the person paying the note encouraged to not pay during that period. In fact, he'd be very much encouraged to pay to keep it from being accelerated or the rate increased. But during a period of deflation, he might very well be encouraged to default, because he could establish, it'd be like refinancing your note. Just refuse to pay, make them go to court, and you'd be dropped to the market rate.
And Mr. Chairman, I suppose that is a possibility if somebody wants to undergo the difficulties associated with litigation in order to pick up 4 or 5 percentage points on inflation, that there may be some reason to do that. But I think for the great majority of financial transactions, if it's not covered by a contract, this would be a superior system in general, and it certainly would benefit a number of the agencies of the state of Alaska. Most particularly agencies that come to mind are the Department of Transportation and Department of Administration through risk management, which pay substantial amounts of interest, substantially above current market rates. Which frankly is just a huge windfall in some cases for people who receive judgments against the state.
Yeah, there's also the other side of that argument, though, Mr. Geldof. I certainly appreciate the fact that we're here to be concerned about the state, but I think we're also here to be concerned about the people who have to bring actions against the state when the state's wrong. as we should be against any person who gets themselves embroiled in the legal system. In essence, what has occurred over the last several years is that with declining interest rates and a fixed court rate of interest, there's been a significant enhancer out there for people with deep pockets to settle suits. I can remember periods of time when our court rate was set at 6% and the insurance companies were earning over 18% and you couldn't get those bastards to settle a case. They wouldn't begin to sit down and write a check. They appealed every single one of them because as long as they held on to their $1 million, they were making 18% on it, and they were only going to have to pay you 6. And the difference in interest bought a whole lot of attorneys to run off to the Supreme Court on specious litigation. Now we've got a situation where, oops, once the judgment comes down, you really got to look at your whole card as to whether or not you want to keep paying 10.5% when the market's sitting there at about 5. So it's been a real incentive to kind of level out that playing field. So there's two sides to this one, and we, the state, kind of get caught in the process of having to make an honest determination. Do we really want to litigate this thing further if, in fact, we're going the odds are 75% we're going to lose? Or are we wiser to pay that thing off today before that interest rate start eating us alive? I just want that on the record. There's two sides to this argument.
I just want to remind you that we're in a formal hearing and ask you to be careful with your language.
I was being very careful. I clearly identified it.
I do have a question. What about instead of using the approach of establishing the interest rate 1 week before the filing and 1 week before the entry of judgment, that we do this on an annual basis or semi-annual or perhaps quarterly and have the Commissioner of Revenue just establish this so we know what it is for a period of time. And so we don't have, as I'm sure Mr. Christensen is going to testify, or I don't know for sure, but we have people at a clerical level in the court system being confused about what the rate might be, and then we know what it's going to be for at least for several weeks. Did you discuss that at all? And maybe you gentlemen weren't the ones with all that much in the discussion, but it seems to me that it would be a more simplified system of accomplishing what we want to accomplish and getting a lot closer to where we want to go than where we are today.
Mr. Chairman, the original concept for the post-judgment interest was derived from the system that the federal government currently uses, only on post-judgment interest. And it is as simple and straightforward as the federal government could devise. And I think, frankly, it took into account that they were dealing with clerks, that they were dealing with judges, and probably most important, the lawyers, who tend to be oftentimes very sloppy on these kind of details. You know, they just want to win the case and kind of let the paperwork and the calculations kind of hang loose. So with that in mind, the system was pegged on T-bills, and there's an 800 number that anybody can call to obtain the week's previous interest rate based on the Treasury bill sales. I won't anticipate all of Mr. Christensen's arguments about why Clerk Gates can't deal with this, but I would just note the calculation, the methodology is the same. It has to be done now twice instead of once under this proposal. The methodology stays the same, and the input values change slightly. That is, they have to get a number, which would be different than everybody knows it's 10.5 in the statute. How the court system distributes that, of course, is up to them, but it seems, to me at least, that a single phone call from the court system on a weekly basis and then dissemination, perhaps through broadcast fax, might do it. If the committee feels that is too difficult and cumbersome after hearing from the court system, then perhaps going to a monthly or even a yearly rate may be warranted if there truly is an onerous burden on the court system. But the principle that the administration and the Attorney General want embodied in the interest rate is something that reflects market rates. The Attorney General obviously feels, you know, the market changes daily, hourly, so we settled on a weekly rate. If the legislature feels that a monthly rate or a yearly rate is better. But in any event, something that isn't just fixed arbitrarily in statute forever and ever until you all revisit it and change it is superior to what we've got now.
Thank you. Do you have further questions? Thank you very much. And if you could stand by, we'd appreciate it. Mr. Christensen? And we have waiting in Anchorage, Ellen Braden, and you will be next to testify if you could come to the microphone following Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, staff counsel to the Judicial Branch of Government. The court system is only concerned with Section 1 of the CS. We have taken no position on the subsequent sections since they don't affect us. We do, however, have to oppose Section 1, and I think as the members know, we don't do this lightly. This is the first time all session long that we've come in and offered opposition to any section of any bill, as far as I can recall. At a very basic level, there's one technical problem we would like to see corrected, and I think that the Attorney General would agree that it was unforeseen, and that is Section 1, the first line states that money interest shall accrue on a money judgment in a civil case. The current statute doesn't say civil case, it just says on a judgment or decree. And we have been interpreting this to allow us to award post-judgment interest on criminal judgments for criminal fines and criminal restitution. And I think this was a sort of an inadvertent slip. I don't think the state wants to lose the ability to charge criminals interest on their restitution or criminal fines. But that's a fairly simple change. However, the bulk of my remarks about Section 1 are go to a much deeper level. We believe that this bill will impose a substantial clerical impact by requiring the rates to change, as the Attorney General has indicated every week. You know, at a time when budgets are being cut, when the court system is facing a $3 million cut in the Senate, and new laws are being passed with zero fiscal notes on them, this bill will result in a measurable increase in our clerical load that we really that is not commensurate with what we believe the legislature or the Attorney General is trying to accomplish. Now, I know that the attorneys, the Range 25 attorneys who drafted this, didn't think it was a problem. Several high-level people at the court system looked at it and didn't think it was a problem. But when we sent it off to the clerks, you know, the people in the branches that actually do the work, they went ballistic. And I've learned through bitter experience with the Victims' Rights Act and some other legislation which affects clerks that you ask these people what's going to happen to them, and then you listen to them. As the bill is structured, we must distribute, probably by facsimile machine, the interest rate. And this would be to 58 different court locations. No doubt, you know, you add up the number of attorneys and governmental entities and banks, other financial institutions, collection agencies, it numbers in the thousands. All these people are going to be calling their court locations every week to find out what the current rate of interest is. Sure, they can get it from other sources, but they're going to be calling us. That's the way life works. Each court location that receives the notice is going to have to distribute it to all the clerks and all the judges who need it. Each of these people needs to keep track of the interest rate over time, because with respect to post-judgment interest, it's just the rate that's in effect that week, the week the judgment is entered. With respect to pre-judgment interest, you're going to have to look back in the past to see what the market rate was when the summons was originally served, maybe several years ago. So we're going to be keeping an ongoing log. Everyone needs to keep their little booklets up to date. Now, there's a significant policy change in the bill that's been touched on a little bit. You know, policy is not a policy we'll comment on, other than to the extent that it affects us, and that is that currently, with contract cases, which are about 80, or with non-tort cases, which are about 85% of the Superior Court civil caseload, interest rates are calculated from the day of the, for example, the breach of contract. Under this bill, the interest rates would be calculated from the date of the service of process after the lawsuit is filed. It's easy for us to know when the contract is breached because it says so in our file. It says so right in the complaint. We don't know when the summons was served because generally we're not told. This means that you know, under the current system, the clerk looks something up in the file to determine the date. Under the new system, she'd have to make phone calls to attorneys or to process servers to try to figure out something that's not in the file. Let me go through the steps of what would happen here. First, the clerk has to figure out what the rate of interest is. And as the Attorney General has indicated, she has to do this twice now instead of just once. But frequently, it's not going to be twice. Many cases have multiple defendants, and those defendants were served in different weeks. You could have four defendants in a case, each with a different rate of interest, which means instead of just doing one calculation for the entire case, you're doing eight different calculations. Second of all, as I indicated, the clerk is going to have to determine the date of service because that information isn't in the file, and this is going to take telephone calls or faxes. And third, the clerk is going to have to do the calculation. Now, I realize that, Range 25 attorneys and the other kinds of people that we have in the room right now may not have trouble doing calculations, but like this. But the people who do these calculations are arranged 8 clerks. A lot of them are in, you know, 2-person Brooke courts. They don't even have high school diplomas in many cases. We're not talking about an intuitive round number like 10.5%. We're generally talking about a number that's carried out to 3 decimal places. You know, the weekly interest rate might be 3.645%. And these people, well, we're not computerized, as you folks know. We got our first computer money in the capital budget last year. It's not a question of putting a number in the computer and pushing a button. We're talking about a range aid clerk using a worksheet and a pocket calculator, trying to figure out a number that changes every week. Now, what's the actual impact of this? We'll try to quantify that. I was talking about this with someone the other day, and they said, well, what's the big deal? Each clerk might spend an extra 15 minutes calculating a judgment compared with what she does now. What's the big deal? Well, Mr. Chairman, the point is we do about 10,000 of these things a year. When you multiply 15 minutes times 10,000, you're talking about a substantial clerical load, especially when we're taking budget cuts, especially when our Superior Court caseload is already up 15% in the last year. The comment was made that this is how the federal courts do it, and it's really pretty simple. Well, of course, first of all, the federal courts only do this with post-judgment interest, not with pre-judgment interest. Post-judgment interest is much easier because, as I said, we know when the judgment was entered. We don't know when the summons was issued, however, in pre-judgment cases. More importantly, federal court is tiny. Mr. Chairman, if you look at the caseload for the federal court for the District of Alaska, it's, I think, less than half of the caseload of Fairbanks alone. Moreover, Mr. Chairman, the federal government prints its own money, and they don't have clerical shortages. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members might have.
Any questions of Mr. Christensen? Thank you. I'm not sure that I agree that your analogy of the 15 additional minutes for doing the calculation. The calculation is pretty basic. You know, you take a number and you multiply it by 0.105 for what you have now, or whatever the number might be. If it's 5%, you know, 0.05, or carrying out the decimal points if you have a pocket calculator, really doesn't make the calculation any more difficult. But looking it up in a book, which you should have a book by weeks, and that to me doesn't seem to be too difficult either. So I'm not sure that I agree with you that this is a particularly difficult exercise.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not just a question of doing 2 calculations instead of 1 calculation. It's a question of finding out when the calculation is supposed to run from, and that's something where you're going to need to call the process server or call the attorney to find out, because that information generally isn't in our files. And as I indicated frequently, it's not just going to be twice as many calculations. It's going to be 4 times as many, or 6 times as many, or 8 times as many, depending on whether or not you've got multiple defendants. So there is, maybe it's an extra 5 minutes a case, but even 5 minutes when you multiply it by 10, 15,000 cases is a good deal of time.
Ms. Christensen, you heard my question earlier about what if we perhaps simplify this by publishing an annual interest rate by the Commissioner of Revenue, or semi-annual or something like that. Would that help in this case? It still would have to look up when the case, you know, when the summons was served, but in that case it would be in which year rather than in what specific date.
Mr. Chairman, that there would still be some additional workload, but that would make things substantially easier. It would eliminate the administrative burden of distributing something 52 times a year. And I think that the kind of people that we have doing this work would find it easier to do if they're dealing with a yearly figure rather than a weekly figure.
Senator Taylor?
I think that would then involve some significant redrafting, because the way you're tagging it right now is based on a week prior to the filing or service of the filing. But that again would depend upon when they were served, that Mr. Christensen. So as a consequence, you probably need to redraft that to be within that year. Would it be your intention, Mr. Chairman, that if in fact we went to an annualized basis as an example, that annualized basis would fluctuate during the term of both pre- and post-judgment? In other words, if I file the suit this year and I'm at 4% interest, interest rate goes to 5 the next year, 6 the year after that, 7 the year after that, and it's in the 7% year that the case finally gets to court and I get judgment. Am I locked in at 5 the year it was filed, or do I compute that year at 5, the next year at 6, and the next 6 months at 7% so as to find out the total of prejudgment interest, and then does it again continue to fluctuate annually until the judgment has been paid?
Well, if I'm answering that, the methodology that fixes the rate is the simpler one, but the second methodology is the more accurate one, the one that tracks the market a little closer. But that would mean, in many cases, having several more calculations. As Ms. Christensen said, something that goes on for several years could be fairly complex, but that is consistent with what is being applied now in the application, for example, from the Internal Revenue Service of interest rates. They do that for various years. Yeah, it's whenever the rate has been adjusted. And however many times they adjust the rates, it's valid for that period of time. Did you care to add anything to that? We have further questions, Mr. Christensen?
Well, just maybe Mr. Christensen could reply. I maybe already have. As concerns the amount of effort and time necessary by your clerks, which system would you prefer?
Mr. Chairman, of course, the simplest system is to simply have one rate for both and leave it fixed in the statute forever, but I understand that's unrealistic. Of course, the next simplest would be to change that rate as infrequently as possible, perhaps once a year. If only one rate did apply to both pre-judgment and post-judgment, that would also make things easier, although if it does change every year, that probably won't happen in many cases.
I guess my concern is that you could literally have an annual fixing of the pre- and post-judgment interest rate, and your clerk be faced 8 or 9 years from now with determining what amount of the execution that's returned to the clerk is in fact interest and what is principal. And she would have to then be able to go back and check the records to be assured, or the judge at least would, to be assured that the interest rates have been properly calculated for the years in between. Because it's highly unlikely that the interest rate, say, would establish itself at 6% and stay there for any number of years. It's bound to be fluctuating, which is then going to require at least a difference in calculation each time that judgment is revisited as it goes through the process of being satisfied.
Further questions? Thank you. We will go to Anchorage on the teleconference network for testimony from Ellen Braden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you receive me? Are you hearing me okay?
We are hearing you very well. Go ahead and state your name and who you represent for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ellen Braden, and I'm the treasurer of the Municipality of Anchorage. One of my functions is the collection of current and delinquent revenues through the municipality. In Anchorage, we have an active collections program which utilizes the small claims court process to collect delinquent taxes and miscellaneous revenues, as well as using our municipal attorney's office to file suit and obtain judgments on debt over the small claims limit. I'm here to offer comments on sections 1 and 2. Section 1 of the bill requires interest to be paid by a debtor on money judgment and ties the rate of interest on the judgment from the last auction price to the 2-week treasury bill. Based on the most recent auction in March, the new rate would be around 3.20%, which is a reduction from the existing fixed statutory rate of 10.5%. Both the existing statute, AS 9.30.070, and this bill make an exception from the statutory interest rate limitation for judgments founded on a written contract where the contract specifies an interest rate. I'm requesting that an exception also be made for the interest charged by a municipality on its delinquent revenue. As written now, this bill will change the interest rate charged to debtors after a municipality has filed suit and obtained judgment resulting in disparate treatment among individuals owing the same type of debt to a municipality, whether it's taxes or annual fees, etc. The only difference being whether or not a municipality has obtained judgment. For example, AS 29.45.250 sets the maximum interest rate municipalities may charge for delinquent taxes. Changing this interest rate at the pre-judgment and post-judgment period would result in unequal treatment of delinquent taxpayers, and as the March Treasury bill favored the most recent 50 basis points. It would also penalize
Depends on how it gets read.
Section 2 of this bill was requested by Anchorage in its legislative package and pertains to the rate of interest municipalities pay on tax refunds. The existing AS 2945-500B requires municipalities to pay a fixed rate of 8% on all tax refunds. The amendment changes the interest rate to the average interest rate of what our municipality earns on its investment in 3 months prior to the refund, thus evening out the financial impact of the municipality. By way of example, during 1992, in Anchorage, we refunded taxes to the property owners and paid over $40,000 worth of interest. This was at the 8% rate, while earning only a little bit over 4% on the money we had invested. As this law is currently written, it's not designed to prevent abuse of this interest allowance. Technically, at 8%, there's nothing to prevent a taxpayer from overpaying at will and receiving a higher than market rate of return on the refund. We don't believe the municipality should be required to pay an excessive interest rate. Another technical suggestion, I would suggest that on page 2, line 20 of the bill, that is written down, the word paid be changed to issued or issued. This will clarify the date the refund check was issued by the municipality as opposed to the date the check was actually negotiated by the payee and paid by a bank. These are obviously two different dates. This concludes my prepared remarks, and I'd like to answer questions from the committee if they have any.
Ms. Braden, in your testimony, you said in Title 29, and I haven't had an opportunity to pull it up yet to look at it, but you pay interest now at 8%, and I assume that's a fixed rate that's in there. How is that different from the rate that's in Title 45 that says the rate of interest is 10.5%? And I know that the municipality of Anchorage, as well as other political subdivisions of the state and the state itself, is paying interest at 10.5% for retainage on contracts, like with contractors who have completed work or substantially complete, yet money is withheld. Is there some difference between the interest rate for property taxes and this other reference that I just mentioned?
Yes, I'm not that familiar with the interest rate to be paid on retainage. I do believe that the statutory rate in different sections of the statutes, the interest that municipalities pay on tax refunds is the fixed rate in 2945. I'm sorry, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Senator Taylor has a question for you.
Yes, have you noted an increase in overpayment by taxpayers in Anchorage over the last few years?
No, I can't say that I've noticed an increase in overpayments. Overpayments result from two things, Senator. Overpayments by the taxpayer, through taxpayer error. For example, a mortgage company would pay in escrowing funds on a mortgage, pays the taxes, and the property owner, homeowner also pays the taxes. So we have a double payment. Now, under the existing statute, we are required to pay 8% interest on that overpayment. A number of overpayments also result from assessor's adjustment to the value. When the value is appealed, changed by the assessor, for example, if a piece of property is assessed for the land and the building and at a later date it becomes apparent that there's an error and that there is no building on the property, then the assessment is changed and the taxes are changed and are refunded. We have those are major reasons for creating these overpayments on the taxes.
No further questions?
Yeah, I was just curious. This appears to be an obvious loophole that someone could maybe take advantage of, although it's a strange one. But you have not seen any flood of people coming in trying to take advantage of the city in this fashion, have you?
Ms. Braden, did you hear the question?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I was just confirming you hadn't seen a flood of people coming in or any kind of increase of people coming in trying to take advantage of the city by overpaying taxes or insisting on those additional interest rates. Although I know it is a problem because of the problem raised by the chairman, and that is a major one. When you have ongoing contracts and you're retaining 10% or whatever to get your final as-built plans in and the rest of it, sometimes that retainage can last for some lengthy period of time, and then to have to pay a 10.5% rate when you're only generating maybe 3 or 4 is very difficult.
Yes, it is another disparity.
Do we have further questions of Ms. Braden? No further questions. Thank you for your testimony. We'll come back to Juno for Larry Myers, Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Larry Myers. I'm Director of the Income and Excise Audit Division for the Department of Revenue, and I'm here to testify on what is now Section 4 of the committee substitute, having to do with the interest rates on overpayments and underpayments, and would like to start off by saying that we are dealing with something that's completely different from what we've talked about previously in this hearing, and I would like to focus on, I have handed out an example that I would like to refer to, and I will apologize. It is, examples were prepared for House Bill 226, and some of the language still shows 226 in it. But I think that gives a pretty good example of what the current law is that we're working under and what this proposed legislation will do. And if I may refer to example one, we've shown a hypothetical of $1 million, and what under current law the state is required to pay out in an overpayment. And then we're showing under the Senate Bill 161 of what the proposed law change rate would be. And I've also gone through and showed you what the current short-term investment earnings that is available to the state for that $1 million while it's sitting within the state's hands. So you can see on example one where the taxpayer pays his income tax liability that under current law we would be required to pay him, that taxpayer, $176,000. We would currently be earning $55,000, and so it's costing the state $121,000, and that's based on the, like I said, the current rate right now, which is 11%. Under the House bill, I mean the Senate Bill 161, that is be substantial savings to the state. In that instance, almost $90,000.
I have a question in this example. Is that interest rate compounded simply? I mean, is that simple interest? I see in the example you have payments in three different calendar years. Are you compounding that quarterly or simpler?
Mr. Chairman, it is based, if you look on page 2 of my example, you will see that the rate is based on various discount rates and that are on a quarterly basis.
Okay.
So it does change. It's very similar to what the IRS does, and we're pretty much piggyback their method.
Do you have questions for Mr. Myers?
And if I could, I would like to move on to example two. This provision of this bill also provides that if a taxpayer comes in and pays their taxes based on an assessment, the distinction between one is they voluntarily paid their normal tax liability. Example two is if they came in and paid on an assessment and that assessment turns out to be too high and we have to refund them the $1 million. As you can see under the current law and the first two columns as well as the overpayment, they are identical. There is a provision in the bill that says that if the Department of Revenue erroneously assesses that we will pay, refund them the interest at the current law rate, so it would be at a higher rate. There are several examples, and I could go into where we would see this potential of paying back if the community is interested.
I'm interested in hearing what some of those are.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one example is that currently we have a 3-year statute of limitation in which we must assess. If we are finding, we're currently working other caseloads, we get some kind of a tip, or we choose to go after and ask the taxpayer to grant us a written waiver of the statute of limitations, and they refuse to do so, then we have to go in and do what we call a jeopardy assessment. That is in an effort to protect ourselves. If they were to go in there and voluntarily pay that, knowing that that they currently could only earn 3-4% and the state could potentially pay them 11%, there's a possibility of abuse there. The next example is if we go in there and we do not issue a correct assessment, we make it an honest mistake. This is an effort here for equity. Those are some examples of what we have. Those are probably the two most prevalent types where we're going to see potential problems out there.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Myers? I don't know if you're the right person to respond to this, but when I saw the bill, it just made me look up this reference in 4545010, the legal rate of interest in the state of 10.5%. I talked about it earlier to Sprague and Anchorage, but the rate that municipalities pay and the state pay on, for example, on retainage, I don't know that there's any particularly good reason for not addressing that issue at the same time we're addressing this, if we're going to deal with interest rates in the bill. And there may be other references throughout statutes that I don't know. And are you familiar with any of these others in your work?
No, Mr. Chairman, I am not.
Okay. Well, we'll get somebody else to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Otteson, you're down here saying, if asked, is there anything that has inspired you to want to testify? If so, please join us.
Very brief, Mr. Chairman. Jeff Otteson, DOT. We basically have two classes of activity where this interest rate comes to bear. One is on a right-of-way acquisition where the price is in dispute. We end up in condemnation. The state's last best offer is deposited in the court. That money is available for the plaintiff to basically take and use, and so we pay no interest in that money. That is our last best offer. But any difference between our last best offer and the final judgment can then bear interest. And currently, it's about 3 times what the market rates are. So there's no incentive to settle if they think they have a good hand. Obviously, there may be incentive on our part, but there are times when we have a legitimate reason to think that we've got a good case, and we go in, and we still end up getting blindsided. We pay a lot of money in interest. The second class of issues is basically construction claims. And it's the same kind of situation. We can have very, very large construction claims, sometimes involving, I know one right now, one of the ferries is $7.5 million. The claim will drag out for years. If the state loses on that issue, we'll be paying 10.5% times $7.5 million times the number of years involved. So it can add up to a lot of money. That's our issue, our concern.
Mr. Otteson, if I could just follow up on my previous question. Do you have any experience with the application of Title 45, 4510, that has the legal rate of interest in the state at 10.5%. Typically, I've seen that applied to, like, retainage, you know, a lot of contracts like that. Is that something, I would assume, in your administration of contracts, you may have the same application, and if so, is that a third area where DOT has substantial experience with the interest rates?
I believe you're correct, and that would be another area that this bill probably ought to address, just to be comprehensive and even-handed.
It seems like it to me, and I just want to make sure that if we do address this issue, we do it comprehensively. Senator Taylor?
Basically, what you would like to achieve, I'm assuming, is a much more level playing field than what you currently have.
Correct, Senator Taylor.
One that will allow that rate of interest to stay somewhat close to what the state is earning by working its money. and what they would find in the marketplace. So that interest as a factor is removed or eliminated from the litigation process that you're involved in, or the retainage process, or whatever.
I believe the current discrepancy between market rates and the statute rate is puts the state at a disadvantage in negotiations and litigation, and we just simply need to level the playing field, as you said, between the parties.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Sure, Geldof, can you just come back for a brief question? Mr. Christensen commented about a what I think he termed a technical, possible technical amendment to the bill on page 1, lines 6 and 7, about interest accruing on a money judgment. And the bill is written out, says in a civil case, he said they're applying it to the criminals. Would the Department of Law object if we change that to include criminal cases as well?
Mr. Chairman, not at all. In fact, that was discussed this morning. Mr. Christensen was kind enough to bring that to our attention, and the Department of Law believes that where restitution is made in a criminal matter, interest should accrue. I also think Mr. Christensen said the way they interpret the existing statute allows them to do that, and with clarification from the legislature, they can get beyond interpretation and have express authority to go ahead and do that. That would benefit everybody, most particularly victims of crime where restitution is made.
Okay, if you have, I could go back and have any suggested language for changing that and provide that to the committee, I'd appreciate it. We're going to work on this and perhaps incorporate some of these other things that we've talked about and bring this back to the committee.
Very good. Mr. Christian and I will both work on that. Come up at least on the point on restitution.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
That is everyone that I have who has signed up in Juneau and has asked to testify on the teleconference network. But let me ask, is there anybody in Anchorage who is on teleconference who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 161? Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify? Senator Taylor?
Mr. Chairman, I suggest maybe conceptual amendment. First would be that we go to an annualized basis on establishing interest rates, and that we utilize the same formula, and that is the United States Treasury bills, and just pick a time at which January 1 or December 31 or whatever the selling date is or selling price is on that date would be the annualized rate for either pre or post judgment interest. And that we need to establish how that portion of a percentage rate would be handled also. In other words, we need to round up or round down so we don't end up having people carry this thing out to the seventh place to try and figure out what these calculations are going to be. In other words, it ought to be 3.5 or 3.0 or, I don't know how exactly to word that, but hopefully the drafters give us some assistance on that. That would be my amendment that I would suggest.
Something like rounded to the nearest 0.5% or something.
Yes.
So it's an easier comp.
Or maybe even to the nearest 0.1%, something like that. I think what we ought to do is probably take that, concept and work with the those who provide testimony, and when we bring this back, have something that we can see before us, and we'll take that amendment up at that time if that's what
sure.
That's what
that'd be
you.
Fine. My only concern is that as we talk here in Juneau, these interest rates are out there running, and they're doing major disservice to our municipalities and also to the state. And as long as that divergence exists, it's going to cost us money and cost the people in Alaska money. I'd like to know that there is some game plan to either get the House bill over here, 226, or get this one on its way. Hopefully the title will be broad enough when it comes over from the House you can still make these adjustments. Because I think it needs to be done if you're looking at a significant fiscal impact if you don't.
Any further comments from the committee regarding this bill? Just a second, I'm going to take a minute easier. That concludes the business for today. Just want to remind you that our next meeting is Monday, the 5th of April, and we will be taking up House Bill 64, anti-stalking law, And Senate Bill 145, the position of the state medical examiner, as well as bills previously heard. There being no further business to come before the committee, we will be adjourned.